Welcome to this Science Progress podcast. My name is Sean Poole, and today is May 26th, 2011. You know, we talk a lot about how science and technology are changing society, from trains, planes, and automobiles that have allowed us to move people and goods around the world to information technology that allows us to shop from home or answer tough questions with a click of a mouse. Technology has really changed the way we live. At Science Progress, we comment on how stem cells, genomics, and synthetic biology are starting to revolutionize medicine, how emergent clean energy technologies are changing our centuries-long relationship with fossil fuels, and how computing in the era of big data is changing the very nature of the scientific method itself. But these are all issues of the here and now. What about the next decade and the one after that? What happens when we can use synthetic biology and 3D printing to literally print new organs, or when nanotechnology allows us to interact with the internet or any other person without turning on a computer? What happens when we download our thoughts or even our entire consciousnesses into the computing cloud, or when the artificial intelligence we create becomes smart enough and powerful enough to optimize and improve upon itself? It could be a very different world, and it may not be as far-fetched as it sounds. Here today to discuss these issues with us is David S. Rose, a serial entrepreneur, angel investor, and track chair at Singularity University. David has been called the father of angel investing in New York by Crain's New York Business and a world-conquering entrepreneur by Business Week. Suffice it to say that David has a lot of experience connecting capital to technology. We're very lucky to have him with us today. So thanks, David, for being here.
It's my pleasure.
So as associate founder and track chair at Singularity University, you lecture and mentor on the dramatic changes in business that have already been caused by accelerating technological innovation and on the forecasting of how future technology may change society as we know it. Could you start by talking a little bit about technology forecasting? What is it and why is it such an important issue?
Well, let me back up a little bit and talk about Singularity University itself, and before even that, the question of the singularity. A guy named Ray Kurzweil, who was one of the smartest folks around, and as a prodigy invented everything from the optical scanner to the Kurzweil musical keyboard to the first reader for the blind, among other things, has written a number of books on the future of technology and the development of technology. One of them was The Age of Spiritual Machines, and a recent one, a number of years ago, was a book called The Singularity is Near. And this is a 700-page, very, very well-researched analysis of technological progress. And the point that Ray makes is that many people have heard of Moore's Law, which had to do with the number of transistors on a chip. Gordon Moore noted.
David and I got into a long conversation about the singularity, but I'll summarize it for you now. The singularity is based on the idea of Moore's Law, which says that computing power doubles about every 2 years. This has held true for the last few decades, and industry experts expect it to remain true for the next few. What this means, however, is that very quickly, as we continue to advance exponentially in our computing power, the rate at which computers will integrate into the rest of our technology will also increase exponentially, until very soon, and according to Ray Kurzweil, as soon as 2045, we'll be entering a paradigm in which humans and computers begin to become indistinguishable, and this is called the singularity. We might have computers in our bodies or in our brains helping to connect us to the internet, increasing the power of human knowledge by orders of magnitude, and that this isn't science fiction. And the point that David makes is that this isn't a new trend. New computing technologies have brought about a series of paradigm shifts, each of which, like an S-curve, has launched us forward, faster, and higher on the technological ladder. Pretty soon, if we aren't already, we'll be relying on our technology for almost everything in our daily lives. And that has serious implications for our society, the economy, maybe even the nature of humanity as we know it. And now let's get back to the conversation.
Bringing, human characteristics and consciousness to machines, or bringing machine power to humanity, or some kind of cooperative effort among the two, but basically leveraging what is the best of us in terms of humans with the power that comes from this exponentially advancing technology. And so the third approach here is to say, well, okay, if you buy the idea of exponential growth, then the question is, well, what the heck do you do about it, and how can you leverage all of this exponentially advancing technology to solve the grand challenges that we have as humans? And to sort of answer that that challenge and that question, a number of far-sighted organizations got together to create something called Singularity University. which is based out at the NASA Ames Research Campus at Moffett Field in Mountain View. And the corporate founders include people like Google and Autodesk and the Kauffman Foundation. So the goal of Singularity University is to, their mission statement is, quote, to assemble, educate, and inspire leaders who understand and develop exponentially advancing technologies to address humanity's grand challenges. Which is a pretty highfalutin kind of concept, but they've really done a great job at getting there. So the first year of Singularity U was 3 years ago, and they had 40 students for postgraduate students in their graduate studies program for a full summer. Last year they had 80. They'll have 80 again this year. And that's 80 out of 1,600 applicants. So it's an extraordinarily selective group. Those 80 participants last year were from 35 countries, so it's a truly global operation. And you know, the average person who had participated in the Singularity U graduate studies program was about 32, had a doctorate, and had started two companies or organizations on their own. So amazingly qualified and taught by a faculty consisting of people like Larry Page of Google and Vint Cerf, who invented the Internet, and three-time shuttle astronaut Dan Barry, you know, people like Ray Kurzweil himself and the like. I have the honor to run the Finance, Entrepreneurship, and Economics program at Singularity U, where we discuss the extraordinary changes that technology is having on business and what the world of business and commerce and everything else would look like in the not-too-distant future when these all of these technologies come into play.
And we've already seen this sort of, in a certain sense, at play in our daily lives. I mean, so many of us now carry around smartphones that can access the Internet or pinpoint your position on the globe within to a margin of error of 3 meters or find, you know, as the nearest open restaurant. Or we've already kind of got to a point where we have amazingly powerful computing.
But if you think about it, yeah, absolutely. And think about how long, that's been, what, less than 5 years?
Yeah.
When you first get your first iPhone with an app on it, right? So and if that's the difference that 5 years can make with our current technology, and technology continues to advance at this doubling rate, which it is, has been doing and continues to do, then you look at all the areas in which this is happening. You had in your introduction discussed, you know, several things in medicine and nanotechnology and other kinds of things. And my role at Singularity University is effectively to pull all this together and say, look what it is doing to society as a whole, and look at the effect of technology on business. What has that been?
So I guess let's skip ahead for a second and talk about what are some of the challenges and opportunities that these trends present to business and to the workforce.
The future effects may actually be surprising to many people, because the first question is, let's take companies. Why do companies exist? I mean, God didn't necessarily create companies. There's nothing necessarily in the natural order that says a company has to exist. But as technology advances and as it takes more people and more specialized things to create anything, from, you know, the Empire State Building to giant computers, you know, for retail use or whatever.
Right, it clearly takes dozens or even hundreds of companies to produce either of those two objects.
It takes a lot of people to do that, right? It takes a lot of individuals working on something. So then the question is, how do you organize these kind of people? And in Adam Smith's world of, you know, the invisible hand and pure, you know, capitalism, everybody individually can, you know, is an actor and contracts with everybody else. And there's a market for buying and selling skills. And so why doesn't everybody just do their thing independently? Well, the guy named Ronald Coase won the Nobel Prize for his theory of transaction costs. His point was that if you can save money by having an entrepreneur override the market, so for example, you could go out and hire a carpenter every time you needed a nail to be hammered into a house if you were building a house. You could say, okay, who's going to, you know, I'm going to go find somebody to hammer this nail in and find somebody else to hammer that nail in. Well, that's really inefficient, right? And so therefore...
I think I see where this is going. So technology is driving transaction costs down.
And so Coase's theory was that companies will grow and grow and grow and grow and get bigger and bigger and bigger until the transaction costs, the external transaction costs, reach equilibrium with the internal transaction costs, right? So therefore, if you go look at Henry Ford started building cars in his garage, but when you started getting into production, you had to have all the various pieces and components of the auto manufacturing, and it made sense to bring a lot of that stuff in-house because back then, in the teens and 20s and 30s, the transaction costs without the internet or whatever of finding suppliers, of shipping things in, of contracting for all the pieces were very high. So therefore, Ford's River Rouge plant in Michigan had something like 100,000 people working in one factory. And that place had, for example, not only the assembly line to make cars, it had its own printing plant to make to print the instruction manuals for its cars, because it was cheaper than going out and finding printers to do one-off instruction manuals. And in matter of fact, it had its own paper mill to make the paper to print the manuals for its cars.
So that's pretty vertically integrated right there.
So it was totally vertically integrated because the transaction costs were cheaper internally than they were externally. What has happened now with the internet, the ability to discover all the various suppliers and sources out there in the world, the ability to contract with them easily online, digitally, the ability in many cases for them to deliver things digitally, art or creative work or research or even services in the cloud, has made it very, very cheap to buy these services, to outsource these services and have them done outside because the transaction costs are very low. As a result, companies are shrinking because if it's cheaper to do it outside, you wouldn't do it inside. So what you saw is companies growing, from the Industrial Revolution and on, companies got bigger and bigger and bigger until the, computer revolution in the last, 20 or 30 years. And now you're seeing it's like a tsunami going the other direction, companies shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. So in the world of the future, where people can be found and market themselves, deliver their things, and be contracted effectively in like pickup vans or crowdsource or outsource stuff, companies need to have very much smaller staffs on a full-time basis and will do a lot more things outside in relationship with other companies. And as a result, you're seeing the company begin to shrink and shrink and shrink. And Google's total worldwide global force of full-time employees is less than worked at that one Ford plant in the 1920s. And that's a trend that's only going to continue as companies are going to shrink and shrink and shrink. And in turn, that means that each individual now becomes responsible for his or her own career. There's not going to be some big company that's going to give you lifetime employment and take care of you with a pension in your old age and tell you what to do and direct you over there. Instead, each person is going to be responsible for managing their own career, managing their own brand, finding their own work, delivering their own work, and taking more responsibility for their lives. And that's going to be a major sea change.
So you're saying we're sort of moving towards a future of every person as their own entrepreneur, and your thesis is that is almost inevitable, just given the power of information technology to reduce transaction costs.
Absolutely, because it's not only is it a question of reducing transaction costs, but if you look at the things that technology is obviating, it's obviating a lot of what used to be menial or service-oriented tasks. We are moving to a self-service world, whether it's doing your own airline tickets on your own computer and having it to your mobile phone. So there's virtually no whole process involved with third parties. It's self-help customer support online or by phone. It is, everything increasingly is getting automated, and the percentage of our GDP that is IT-based is also growing exponentially over time. So as this happens more and more and more, the jobs that will be lost, unfortunately, without a value judgment, will tend to be those at the base of the pyramid, the service jobs. And then the next set of jobs to go are the intermediary jobs. You already take a look at the floor of the New York Stock Exchange with all the specialists on the floor waving tickers around. That's all gone. The New York Stock Exchange floor today is virtually a television set. There is little that happens on the floor itself. NASDAQ, for example, has no floor. And so in a number of years, brokers, when I was seeing real estate brokers, it used to be they had the knowledge, they were the only ones who could make this deal. Now you're seeing for sale by owner, you're seeing access by consumers to multiple listing sites, you're seeing people doing their own stock trades. So the whole intermediary role is disappearing.
And that's because technology is just connecting us, is connecting people, buyers and sellers together without the need for an intermediary or without the need for a broker. So what you're basically saying is human jobs are being replaced by the power of this exponentially increasing information technology to connect people, buyers, sellers, what have you. And that is going to spread its way higher and higher and higher up the value add types of jobs in the economy.
So from service jobs and menial jobs on the bottom end. I mean, agriculture used to employ the largest number of people in the country, and you're now seeing retail kiosks at airports. So instead of having stores, you're having vending machines that will sell you a computer or an iPod or a headset. Some of the latest developments are kiosks that don't even need to be stocked by a real person. When it's a broadband-connected kiosk, and as it empties its various wares, it automatically signals a central depot, which sends out a replacement canister by UPS. The UPS guy comes up to the kiosk, holds it up against the kiosk. It automatically, through RFID, unlocks the thing. He pulls out the old one, puts in the new one, closes it, and away you go. So you're seeing increasing automation at every stage of industry, and that means that the increasing roles are going to be dedicated to, on the one hand, personal producers who are creating something that people need, and on the other hand, entrepreneurs who have the ability to pull together resources, varied resources that are available out there, on the web, in the cloud, whether it's people, those individual, personal producer resources, creative people and the like, or whether it is services, facilitated services, logistics, shipping from UPS or FedEx or hosted cloud computing services from Amazon or whatever, and pull all these together.
So I mean, this sounds a little scary. I mean, what if I don't want to be an entrepreneur? What if I want to go and have a stable, safe job with a company that will take care of me? You're saying that this is going to be harder and harder to do in the future. These very profoundly powerful trends, you say you're an optimist. To me, they sound scary. Should we be looking at these trends as opportunities, as challenges? Should we be excited about this potential future, or should we be worried about it?
You are not the only one who is scared, because this is counter to everything we've thought about. This is counter to the way our parents were brought up in the 1940s and 50s and 60s. I'm not making a value judgment here. I'm not saying this is good or this is bad. What I am saying is this is. And the idea of, because of these rapidly decreasing transaction costs, and they are dropping again exponentially, the need for a company to keep people on staff for a 20 or 30 year career to do the same kind of thing, day in and day out, is just disappearing. Unfortunately, those days are gone. And so it is going to force society to take a very hard look at itself, and the people who will be able to thrive are the people who will be self-starters. And if you are expecting, if for a kid getting out of college today, to expect that she or he will find a nice, cushy, berth at a nice salary like their parents had and be told what to do, and even if they work diligently at it for the next 30 years, that's just not going to happen. And so, yeah, the answer is I think that this is a real challenge for our society to figure out how to deal with that.
Even with just the very mundane, everyday technologies that we all take for granted, take, for example, writing, reading, books, the internet. You already have a whole population of people who've been left behind. I mean, depending on what study you look at, between a quarter and a third of American adults are functionally illiterate. So how are we going to cope in a future where skills like reading, science, math, technology are placed at an ever higher and escalating premium when we can barely keep people up to a standard of education to cope in our present technological paradigm?
You have a very real question, and let me give you some even scarier examples, right? So the majority of students in New York City are in public schools in New York City, where I live, and the majority of students in the New York City public schools will not graduate from high school.
The majority of
New York City public school students will not graduate from high school. That is an insanely scary kind of thing. So forget a college graduate who can't find a job or a graduate student who can't find a job. You're talking about not only people with high school degrees, people who didn't get out of high school. And so, you tell me how somebody who can't make it out of high school is going to function much less than full literacy, is going to function in a world where they have to take control of their destiny and effectively be an entrepreneur or create something or be entrepreneurial about what they do with their life. And you get to be a very scary point in the world where you begin to develop either an underclass or people who you're not going to, what happens to them? And so I think this is a major policy question where we as a society have to decide, if somebody, even if somebody is willing to work, let's say they have decent values and they are willing to work, but they don't have either the advanced education that will let them be, taking part in creating this new technology, nor do they necessarily have innate creativity to be a writer or an artist or a designer or a whatever. What are they going to do? Increasingly, as technology takes over the tasks that can be done without, specific skill, without specific creativity, without an entrepreneurial, bent, then there are less and less of those things for people to do, less and less service jobs, less and less intermediary kinds of jobs. And we as a society, I believe, in the not-too-distant future, are going to be faced with a real challenge for, like all these people now whose unemployment has been there for longer than a year, who initially, went out of work during the recession. And the recession, which was an economic recession, caused by the housing, over housing boom and the like, masked part of these changes that have been happening because of technology. And so the companies that are coming back now are not employing more people, I believe. They are employing fewer. Now, let me, in all fairness, note one major caveat to what I'm saying. And that is that even though this is my personal analysis of where things are going, Ray Kurzweil, the author of The Singularity Is Near, and chancellor of Singularity University, strongly disagrees with me. And so Ray is an optimist, and Ray would note that despite technological progress at an exponential rate over the last century, there are more people employed today than there were in the early part of the century.
More people total.
More people total, and even though Keynes in 1928 wrote about the concept of technological unemployment and foresaw exactly what I'm talking about now, Ray would argue that this new technology will continue to find new ways to employ people and new things for people to do, and to some extent I believe he's right. And so, for example, there's something called Amazon Mechanical Turk, which is, for those of your listeners who haven't heard about it, Amazon has a little side project where anybody who is building a computer system or a process that needs some kind of human task being done, writing a review of a restaurant, looking at a picture and saying, is this a person or a dog, whatever, your computer system can take that one task and drop it into Mechanical Turk, and then anybody anywhere in the world can come in, pick up this one task from Mechanical Turk and do it, and put it back into the system, saying, yes, it's a dog, or, here's a five-line review of this restaurant, or whatever, and then get paid for it. And so it's an automated system for farming out piecework, effectively, to anybody in the world. And at any given time now, there are something like 100,000 different tasks that can be done. And so, therefore, yes, there's more employment because anybody, anywhere in the world, including in a hut in the outskirts of Botswana, can, as long as they have access at a community center to a computer and can speak English, could pick up, this one task, do it, and get paid, 2 cents, 3 cents, $5, whatever. And so, therefore, there is a role for humans. But my personal belief, and Ray disagrees with me strongly on this, I will caveat, is that as companies shrink and people need to get more entrepreneurial, we as a society are going to face a significant challenge because we are not training our populace to be able to deal with this.
It sounds like either way, whether you're an optimist or a pessimist on this issue, educating our kids in science, technology, engineering, math, these kinds of skills, that's going to be something that we're going to have to focus on a lot harder if we want to.
It is critical, if for no other reason than one of the things we discuss at SU is the whole concept of globalization, and not just globalization in that our factories are going to China, but globalization in the much larger sense of you really have to treat the entire world these days as one single organism, as one single market. This globalization means that you are bringing on extraordinary workforces from the other part of the rest of the world who are now learning. And even if they're not all getting, multi-doctorates in nuclear physics, the fact that you are bringing, 1 billion or 2 billion people into the educated mainstream means they are competing with Americans. And meanwhile, We have not kept pace. Our science, technology education, and math education is nowhere near the top of the world. It's a real challenge for our society.
And it sounds like with tools like this Amazon Mechanical Turk, making outsourcing even easier. It's really going
to
be...
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the knee-jerk reaction is to be protectionist and to say, America, love it or leave it, we're going to keep, we're going to provide economic incentives to keep all of our business here. We're going to tax and tariff things from outside. But that's a short-sighted approach. I mean, this tidal wave is out there. It is coming. It is happening in real time. And like King Canute, you can't send the tides back. So we need to function as a society and figure out how we are going to take our place in this world on the merits, not by protecting things, because like the floods in the South, you can't stop it. It's happening.
So we've gone over time, actually. But just to wrap up here, sounds like we've identified training our kids in science, technology, engineering, math. That's going to be a critical priority going forward. It is today, and it will continue to be all the more important. Are there any other, what other kinds of policy implications do these trends have? Or are there any? Can we even know yet?
Yeah, I mean, they would tend to indicate that the protectionist kind of stuff is only a short-term Band-Aid, and that's protectionist, that's on either side. And government incentives to paying for things internally or taxing the other guys or prohibiting them or whatever. We are you can't be an isolationist. We are in a globalized world, and we need to accept that fact and then move forward. And our challenge is, how do you keep America strong, and how do you encourage our populace to continue to be at the forefront of the world, in which you are on a much, much more level playing field? And I think a lot of that has to do with the private sector. I mean, I am an unrequited capitalist and an entrepreneur. I started companies when I was 10 years old. And so on the one hand, while I recognize that not everybody is an entrepreneur and only some small percentage of the population is, we need as a society to be more entrepreneurial, to support entrepreneurship, because that's where, Schumpeter's creative destruction comes from. You destroy the old stuff by creating the new that is better, faster, cheaper, and that's where innovation lies. And so as a country, I believe we need to strongly support innovation. We need to strongly support private sector innovation, encourage the natural entrepreneurship and ingenuity and creativity and energy of the private sector in the U.S.
So everyone as their own entrepreneur is what it sounds like this future is going to look like. And I do thank you for your time. Any last thoughts to add before we wrap this up?
I really do believe that America has an extraordinary future ahead of it, but it is one that to correctly deal with this and dealing with these massive changes that are affecting us, and they're here and now. Whether most people don't see it, most people can only see their particular industry, but when you start pointing out to everybody that everybody's industry is changing and is changing irrevocably and deeply and fundamentally, and what that means as a whole for society, means that ultimately, because you're dealing with a globalized world where there are 6-7 billion people out there, all of whom are going to be functioning in this area, we have to encourage this wonderful individual American entrepreneur and worker and creative person to function. And it's not going to happen by a paternalistic society, either in the private sector with jobs for life or in the public sector with guaranteed employment or a Works Progress Administration. It's a different way of thinking for a lot of people, and I think that we can do it, but it's going to require a complete reset of our mindset.
And I would love to get into where the market failures are today that necessitate public policy, and how they might be changing given the changing nature of technology, business, and society, but we do not have time to get into that. Thank you, David.
My pleasure.
Again, David S. Rose is CEO of AngelSoft, which is a standard collaboration platform for over 35,000 early-stage investors in 65 countries, and is founder and chair of New York Angels, one of the most active angel investment groups in the country. David has helped to fund over 75 startup companies.
You've been listening to the Science Progress podcast series.